From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the musician some critics consider the greatest living jazz improviser. We talk with tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins. Also today, how to fend off an angry elephant. We talk with Emmy Award-winning filmmakers Derek and Beverly Joubert about following a herd of elephants in Botswana for their National Geographic special, which airs next week on PBS. The Jouberts have spent the past 10 years in the African bush, filming zebras, hyenas, lions, and other wild animals. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says he's close to making a decision on whether to lift the trade embargo against Vietnam. His decision is expected to come by the end of the week. Published reports indicate that senior White House aides are recommending that Mr. Clinton lift the embargo. Several veterans groups and families of missing American servicemen are denouncing the suggestion. They say Vietnam hasn't done enough to account for the U.S. service personnel who are unaccounted for from the Vietnam War. The Pakistani and Turkish ministers traveled to Sarajevo today to meet with government officials and to try and refocus world attention on the 22-month-old war there. Joel Brand reports from the Bosnian capital.
The two leading women of the Islamic world received a warm welcome in Sarajevo. Western leaders have been met by boos and jeers from Sarajevans disappointed in the West's inaction. Outside the Bosnian presidency building, a crowd of residents showed up to wave and applaud Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan and her Turkish counterpart Tanju Şiler. The turnout was yet another indicator that the mostly secular Bosnian Muslims are increasingly turning to the Islamic world for leadership. Many observers say the inaction of Western countries has sown the seeds for Bosnia to become Europe's first Islamic state in 70 years. Both prime ministers challenged the West to act more effectively in Bosnia. The tone of the visit was strongly in favor of more action to help the republic's mostly Muslim population. However, the two politicians carefully avoided spelling out just what the West should do. For National Public Radio, I'm Joel Brand in Sarajevo.
Two senators are introducing a bill to benefit homemakers. Republican Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas and Democrat Barbara Mikulski of Maryland are introducing a bill that gives homemakers the same deductions on individual retirement accounts that working spouses can claim. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Under current law, married couples with one paycheck are restricted to an IRA deduction of $2,250, while couples with two wage earners are allowed to deduct almost twice as much, $4,000. The bill drafted by Hutchison and Mikulski would change that and allow one-check families to claim the full deduction. Senator Mikulski says the government shouldn't be in the business of penalizing those who stay at home to care for their families.
Many women do not have linear careers because they work and then will have their children, return to the marketplace, and then back out. Often, their pension plans are spotty, erratic, and most often skimpy.
Five of the women in the Senate are sponsoring the bill, and Mikulski says they're considering trying to get it attached to either the larger welfare or health care reform packages to help ensure passage this year. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 11 points at 39.75. This is NPR. The defense has begun calling witnesses in the murder trial of Byron Delay Beckwith. He's charged with killing civil rights leader Medgar Evers 30 years ago. Two previous murder trials ended in mistrials. Defense lawyers began today by reading transcripts from an earlier trial. They have also offered testimony from two police officers who say they saw Beckwith 90 miles away from the spot where Evers was killed the night he was murdered. Beckwith maintains his innocence. This is the fourth anniversary of the South African president's decision to end apartheid. President F.W. de Klerk and African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela are using the occasion to campaign for the country's first all-race elections in April. The BBC's Tom Carver reports.
In this pre-election period, every anniversary in South Africa is being used for campaigning by both the ANC and the National Party. Nelson Mandela laid a wreath outside the entrance to Victor Verster Prison from where he was released in 1990. in honour of all those who had suffered under apartheid. Shortly afterwards, he told a crowd of supporters in a nearby stadium that opinion polls consistently showed the ANC to be the most popular party, but he warned them against complacency. Meanwhile, President de Klerk is preparing to kick off a major congress of his national party, at which the party's candidates in the election will be presented for the first time. President de Klerk admitted that he would have liked more than 25% of the party's list to have been black. At the moment, most polls suggest that the National Party will end up with around 15% of the vote.
Tom Carver reporting. Israel's foreign minister says the PLO chairman doesn't want a separate Palestinian state in the West Bank. Shimon Peres says PLO chairman Yasser Arafat wants to link the West Bank with Jordan in a new confederation. That would be in lieu of creating a Palestinian state on the land Israel captured in the 1967 war. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is a jazz musician who may have no living equal, Sonny Rollins. Rollins started recording in the late 40s and played with the musicians now in the pantheon of modern jazz, Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk, Bud Powell, Miles Davis, Max Roach, and Clifford Brown. The best way I can think to introduce Rollins is to read something by critic Francis Davis. He writes, "When conjuring up an image of the quintessential jazz man, heroic, inspired, mystical, obsessed, as often as not it is Rollins we picture. He is the greatest living jazz improviser, he may be the greatest virtuoso that jazz has ever produced." Later in the show, we'll hear an excerpt of tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins' latest album, Old Flames, but let's open with him soloing on Skylark, recorded in 1972.
Said to me one time that if it wasn't for music, life wouldn't be worthwhile living. I mean, I'm sort of paraphrasing what he said, but you know, if I don't play for a little while, I get physically sick. You know, if I don't play my horn for a while, for a few days or whatever, I actually begin to get sick, and I wonder, well, gee, what's the matter with me? Then I realize, well, I haven't played my horn for a few days.
When you're performing and you're improvising, are you thinking?
Well, no, not really. No, I don't think. That's why I really practice and I keep these exercises and so on, because when I'm actually on the stage and performing, the optimum condition is not to think. I just want the music to play itself. I don't want to have to think about it. If I have to think about what I'm doing, then the moment is already gone, you know?
Are you analyzing what you're playing as you're doing it, saying, oh, this is good, or oh, I don't like this, I've got to find something that's working better?
When I'm really playing at my best, I can hear what I'm doing, but after it's done, but I can't hear it while I'm doing it. And there are some occasions when I really can stand back mentally and sort of listen to myself play. The music just plays itself. I'm just a person standing there with the, moving my fingers and so on. And there are certain times when actually it's out of body experience, so to speak.
What do you do when you practice now? I mean, you're a brilliant player. You're a veteran player. I think a lot of people of your stature would probably just perform and not exactly practice anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, when you play a reed instrument, I mean, it might be true with other instruments as well, but when you play a reed instrument, you have to deal with your embouchure, which is the position of your lips around your teeth and the instrument and the mouthpiece of the instrument. And this has to form a sort of a cushion. And if you don't play for a while, what will happen is that your lips would bleed when you play, and even split. Your lip might split. It's happened to me when I've had to lay off for a period of time. For other things, I'm not certain. I practice a lot of things, but I read once where my friend Max Roach said that a lot of musicians shouldn't really practice. Practicing is cheating after you reach a certain point. So that may be right, but in the case of just keeping my embouchure from bleeding and my lip from splitting, I like to play a certain amount every day, you know.
Sonny Rollins is my guest. One of the things that I love about your playing is your repertoire, the songs that you choose to play. And you have a really diverse repertoire, and you play a lot of old pop songs that many people don't know or have forgotten, as well as some songs that are like novelty songs, like, you know, Tootsie and I'm an Old Cow Hand, and Noel Coward songs. Are these a lot of these songs you grew up with?
Yeah, a lot of them are songs that I heard when I was a youngster. When I was growing up, the big thing to do every week was go to the movies on Saturday. And on Saturday, we used to see a lot of these movies that had this scores in it, you know, by some of the composers. And we'd see Louis Armstrong and pictures and different musical personalities that I enjoyed a lot. Of course, I also heard music around the house and so on, but the movies did provide a certain large part, I think, of some of the things that I play today, you know.
When you started performing, was it hard to find other musicians who liked the same songs you did and who wanted to play them? I mean, even back in the days when you were playing with Miles Davis or with Clifford Brown, did they share your musical taste?
I would say, basically, yes. People like Coltrane and Clifford Brown, we all had an appreciation of what they would call today the standard songs. It is, in my case, I might have found some more obscure songs.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, like, propose playing something like Tootsie and have other musicians look at you like you were crazy?
Well, they might have thought so, but they wouldn't dare to say it.
Well, why don't we pause here?
It was my gig, you know.
Right, right. Why don't we pause here and play your recording of There's No Business Like Show Business? I love what you do with it. This is Sonny Rollins. There's No Business Like Show Business. Sonny Rollins, recorded in 1955. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ Back with tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins, his latest album is called Old Flames. You grew up in Harlem, in New York, and your parents, I believe both of your parents, were from the Virgin Islands?
That's right.
What were your parents' ambitions for you? Did they push you to excel when you were young?
Yeah, well, I was the youngest child. I have an older brother who was a very fine classical violinist. He ended up being a physician. Then I had an older sister who was also sang a lot in church and everything. And so I was supposed to follow in their footsteps. Of course, I didn't because I was somewhat of a black sheep. They were much more studious than I. And I wanted to hang out and play ball. And as the years went on, I was really the guy that was out going to jazz clubs and all that. These things were frowned on at that time.
The jazz life when you started to play actually had a lot of heroin involved with it.
Right.
And you got involved with that for a while when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you would have tried something like that if it weren't for it being such a part of the jazz world in the 50s?
I don't think I would have actually. There would really have been no reason, I don't think, to get involved with that. I got involved with it because a lot of my idols were doing it and so on. So we thought that using drugs was sort of the thing to do. But this is something like asking whether Billie Holiday would be the singer she is if she didn't use drugs. I've had this discussion often with people. And my answer is that, yes, I think Billie Holiday would be the singer she is regardless of what happened to her. I mean, even though she may sing about hard times and all that, she was a consummate musician and beautiful singer. So, yes, I think that she would sing the way she did. Charlie Parker would play the way he did. Everybody would do what they did.
It must have been your parents' worst nightmare when you entered the jazz world and then started using.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, my mother was pretty, since I was a baby, my mother really, she stuck by me regardless of what I did. She was really in my corner, but I had a lot of problems from the rest of my family. My father, my grandmother, they really were pretty down on me. And my siblings, they didn't really understand where I was coming from anyway. But I have to say that my mother really believed in me all the way. And I'm really happy that I was able to get myself together before she left the scene. So she kind of saw me start to make records and so on like that. So I sort of made her feel that her trust wasn't exactly all in vain, you know.
Were you ever arrested?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I was arrested. Unfortunately, I had to get involved with the justice system and all of this stuff, you know. But I was always lucky because I was able to get involved with music programs.
In the prison?
Right. And in those days, there were other musicians there, you know, so.
Did it scare you when you were in prison? Did you say to yourself, like, what am I doing here?
Yeah, it scared me a lot. But, again, I was lucky because I could play an instrument.
And
a lot of the other prisoners knew of me, so I immediately had respect from them.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, being locked up is no joyride.
How did you straighten out?
Well, it took a little while, but you know, I slid back a couple of times and everything. But I eventually had gotten down to the complete bottom. So I couldn't have gotten any worse, you know. I mean, I was really in a complete.
What was the bottom?
Well, the bottom was sleeping in park cars in garages and all that stuff, you know, and what we used to call in those days carrying the stick. Carrying the stick meant that you were homeless, I guess. Today they would just say, guy's homeless. But I did this mainly when I was in Chicago. Chicago was where I was sort of was out there on my own. In New York, even though I was persona non grata at home, I could always perhaps get by or sneak in the house or something. But when I was really away from home, I really had to pay a lot of dues, as we used to say.
How would you protect your horn during the periods when you were homeless?
Well, I didn't protect my horn. I mean, I didn't have a horn, really.
Were you borrowing other people's horns?
I was borrowing other people's horns, yeah, yeah.
What did you learn about yourself during that period?
Well, what I learned about myself? Well, I learned that I had the strength to get over something, which was really deep. And I think one of the things that I always feel good about myself was that I was able to overcome that, because I really had to struggle. You know, when I came away from the hospital one time and I went back to the nightclub, it was really the classic scene of the old drug pushers standing there saying, come on, man, come on, you know, and this is good. And I really went through the classic scene of fighting myself, you know, saying, well, gee, if I go with them, it wouldn't be so bad. It's just one time, and maybe I should do it, and why not, and this. And then that's the other part of me saying, no, don't do it. You know, I mean, the real classic battle between good and evil, right and wrong, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, I won out, you know, and that's one thing that I really feel good about myself. You know, I really went into the lion's den and came out alive. And then after that, it increasingly got easier and easier to say no to drugs, which was really a debilitating thing for people to do.
Once you found that strength and knew that you had it, how else were you able to use it in your life?
Well, then I felt I could do anything, you know, and I could get back to what I really wanted to do, which was my music.
So how do you use that strength in your music?
Well, I don't know. I think I always had had strength in my music, even when I was a kid, and I used to practice for hours and hours and hours at a time. I mean, I always had something within myself which enabled me to be alone and play and get into what I'm doing and not think about anything else and really get into this stuff myself. So actually, by getting rid of these negative elements, I was just able really to return to what I had in the beginning, you know.
Tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins is my guest. Over the years, you've taken several hiatuses. There have been several periods where you haven't performed, and I think one period like that lasted, was it 5 years? Was that the longest?
It's hard to say. I took a hiatus on the bridge, which was pretty well documented.
Right, this was during the period when you were practicing on the Williamsburg Bridge in New York, because it was too loud for you to practice in your apartment.
Right.
So, but what were some of the reasons that have led you during different times of your career away from performing?
Well, there was also a period when I ran into a lot of difficulty with the powers that be in the music business. I mean, I was looked upon as sort of a person that was hard to get along with. Somehow I got that reputation, I guess, because I tried to demand a certain amount of money, or I didn't want to be messed around like a lot of guys or whatever, but I've always dealt with that during my whole career in one way or another.
So when you take a hiatus, when do you know it's time to get back to performing?
Well, when I took my hiatus on the bridge, it became apparent because I had sort of gotten what I wanted to do. I was trying to really accomplish something musically, and I'd sort of gotten close enough to what I was doing that I felt if I stayed there, it might have turned into a self-indulgence, and that's not what it was about. Mm-hmm. So I'd sort of gotten to that point when I realized, well, it's time to come back. I didn't accomplish everything that I wanted to, but I felt I accomplished enough that I proved the point to myself.
I'd love to know what it feels like to play your horn on the Williamsburg Bridge. And this was the period when you weren't performing, but you were practicing a lot on the bridge, I guess in the middle of the night?
Well, yeah, we played in the night and in the daytime anytime. It was actually a beautiful place to play because it was a nice space up there. You were really on top of the subway. The trains that came across the bridge were underneath you.
You were on the pedestrian walk?
Yeah, the pedestrian walk. So it's really a nice space up there, and you're sort of right in the middle of everything. You can see the Manhattan and on the other side Brooklyn, and the boats would be coming by at night, and you could blow as loud as you want, and nobody would even look at you. You know, every now and then people would walk by, but nobody would even look. You know, I mean, this was the sophistication of New Yorkers.
Yeah, New Yorkers are immune to everything. do you think your sound got bigger during that period?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it did have certain good effects, really.
Do you feel that you're living the life that you're supposed to be living now? You know, performing when you want to perform, living in the country in New York with also an apartment in Manhattan. I mean, do you feel that you've designed the right life for yourself?
Yeah, I feel I've designed the right life for myself. However, as I'm getting older, I'm beginning to feel that I want to perform more. You know, as Count Basie said, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon now for me. So it's a lot of time now when I might be off for 6 weeks or so. And I'm beginning to feel now that I'd like to be playing a little more because there's less time. Let me put it that way. There's less time for me to do everything that I want to do.
You feel you're getting older and you want to get in as much as you can.
As much as I can. Yeah. So I have to sort of temper my strategy a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, knowing that you'll be performing more is actually very good news. So I'm really glad to hear that. It's just been a pleasure to talk with you. We've been wanting to talk with you on the show for so long. Thank you,
Sarah.
So much for doing it. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
Sonny Rollins' latest album is called Old Flames. Within the next couple of months, he'll perform in Nashville, Philadelphia, Berkeley, Boulder, Kalamazoo, Tarrytown, and Cambridge. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Where's the best place for a cameraman to stand when hyenas are feasting on a zebra or two elephants are mating? Coming up, we talk with filmmakers Beverly and Derek Joubert. They've spent the past 10 years living alone in the Botswana bush, tracking and filming wildlife. Their documentaries have been shown on public television. Their new one about a herd of elephants airs next week. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton's nominee for defense secretary is warning of a possible nightmare scenario in North Korea. William Perry says the end of the Cold War hasn't reduced military threats to the United States. Perry is beginning confirmation hearings to head the Pentagon. He is currently deputy defense secretary. He told the Senate Armed Services Committee today that Washington is aggressively pursuing diplomacy to deal with a possible nuclear-armed North Korea. Perry says he supports sending Patriot anti-missile batteries to South Korea, but he says a final decision by President Clinton is still pending. Mr. Clinton says he has not decided yet whether to lift the trade embargo against Vietnam.
I've not made a final decision, but we are reviewing it. We'll be reviewing it over the next couple of days. I'll have a decision, I'd say, within the next several days.
Several published reports indicate U.S. officials are advising the president to lift the 19-year-old trade ban. The Senate has approved a non-binding resolution asking Mr. Clinton to end the sanctions. The United States has opposed lifting it before because it wants Vietnam to account for all missing U.S. servicemen. More than 2,200 American service personnel are still unaccounted for. The liftoff countdown is progressing at the Kennedy Space Center. Engineers are worried about cold weather. Low temperatures could alter plans for an on-time launch tomorrow morning. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE has this report.
Temperatures are expected to drop to 44 degrees tomorrow at launch time. That's well within NASA rules, which prohibit a liftoff when the thermometer drops below 36 degrees. The cold weather does, however, raise concerns about ice forming on the shuttle's large external fuel tank. De-icing could delay the liftoff. Cold weather was also to blame for a hardening of the booster O-rings in 1986, which contributed to the Challenger explosion. Booster heater blankets have since become part of the pre-launch process. Despite the cold temperatures, forecasters still predict a 70% chance of acceptable weather at liftoff, currently scheduled for 7:10 Eastern Time. Discovery's crew of six will include a Russian cosmonaut, the first to ever fly aboard a U.S. space shuttle. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The Justice Department says it has closed its investigation of Commerce Secretary Ron Brown. The investigation focused on charges that Brown took $700,000 to help lift the trade embargo against Vietnam. Brown's attorneys say the case closure would indicate that he has been cleared by the investigation. A government official says a federal grand jury in Miami found no wrongdoing by Brown. Stock prices rallied today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 11.5 points to end at 3,975. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The government says new home sales shot up 9.7% in December. The Departments of Commerce and Housing say the sales hit their highest level in 5 years. Sales were up in every region except the Northeast. Some analysts had predicted new home sales would rise a little more than 3%. They felt new home sales could not keep up the staggering growth pace that was reported in November at 11.3%. Several cities are suspected of diverting federal money to projects never approved by Congress. Appropriations Subcommittee says some local governments are allegedly misusing money intended to improve airports. NPR's Barbara Campbell reports.
The report says some communities are getting an unfair advantage over others because they not only have airports, which can be big moneymakers, but they also have the federal government paying for improvements to the airports. And the money that cities would have used to keep their big assets, the airports, in good shape, is now being used to meet expenses that all communities face, like police protection and homeless shelters. Congressman Bob Carr says the Federal Aviation Administration is supposed to make sure that federal grants don't replace income generated by the airport.
The FAA is not in any meaningful way enforcing the requirements that airport monies stay on the airport.
Carr wants the FAA to crack down on the practice, even if it means cutting off federal airport, highway, and mass transit funds to those communities. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
The president of the U.S. Figure Skating Association says public opinion won't determine if Tonya Harding stays on the Olympic team. Claire Ferguson told CBS today members of a special association committee will decide if Harding will stay in the Olympics only after checking the facts. Harding's ex-husband, Jeff Gillooly, says Harding helped plan the attack on Nancy Kerrigan. She denies this. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Filmmakers Derek and Beverly Joubert shoot scenes most of us will never get to see firsthand, like hyenas feasting on a zebra and elephants mating. Their award-winning documentaries have been shown as National Geographic specials on public television. Their new one, Reflections on Elephants, airs next week. The Jouberts rarely see other people. They live in the bush most of the year, tracking animals in a customized jeep. They emerge from their camp only to edit their films. The Jouberts, who are married, grew up in South Africa and met in high school. Their new film about elephants shows something rarely captured on film, an elephant dying. This was an old elephant they'd been tracking for several months. They'd first seen this elephant in 1981. I asked them to describe the death.
First of all, it was an intensely dry time, so he was desperate for water. There wasn't a lot of grazing around as well, so what they had to do, all the bulls, is leave the area and go and graze and then walk at least 2 to 3 kilometers or more back to the water. And there's very little water around, so most of the healthy bulls had really dominated the water area and he couldn't get to it. And he stood around through the heat of the day and into the night for hours waiting to get to water, and eventually he braved it and he went in. And once he started to drink, one of the more dominant bulls actually jostled with him and moved him off, and he still didn't move. And of course, he eventually got a tusk right into the side of his neck, and he dropped down and bled to death. He was just so weak that he just couldn't get up, and he died there.
Why would an elephant gore a member of its own herd?
Well, I don't think he intentionally meant to gore him, obviously not even knowing the weakness that that bull was in. But that is the way that they perform around water that is so little at the time. And the more dominant bull would drink first and then move off, and then the second one in charge would drink, and that's the way it would go. And if somebody steps out of line, the bull that would be drinking that is in charge will definitely just try and put that one bull back into line. And that's what happened. I think it was more an accidental death.
How did the elephants respond when this one elephant was dying?
It was stunning, actually. We didn't even realize what we were going to witness, but we moved in there for about 8 days and 8 nights to follow the complete cycle of this death and the carcass. The other bulls spent a lot of time around that carcass. They would go up to it and they'd smell it and they would investigate the carcass all the time, paying particular attention to the ivory, I might add. But there were some really eerie moments where, in particularly in the early afternoon, about 4 in the afternoon, the bulls would all gather around this carcass and simply stand there for 15 or 20 minutes, not doing anything, not even smelling it, and then they'd all disperse again. So it was a very moving and touching time, I think.
How long did it take after the elephant died for the hyenas to come and start feeding on the corpse?
It was actually very quick, because they actually heard the death screams of this elephant. And they were also in the vicinity at the time, because obviously they wanted water as well. So I would say it was almost 20 minutes at the most, and they were there. They didn't start feeding straight away because the bulls wouldn't allow them to feed. First of all the other elephants came in, and they started first of all trying to pick the carcass up. And some of the bulls, that the younger bulls, all of a sudden started doing a mock mating display on the bull that had died on the carcass. And shortly after, once the bulls had left the carcass, did the hyenas come in. But then the bulls constantly would come in and chase the hyenas periodically through the night.
How many days does it take for the elephant corpse to be consumed?
This one was remarkably quick. It was 8 days and 8 nights.
Are there any leftover parts? What happens to the ivory?
Well, the bones get scattered for a start. Hyenas, you know, run off with bits and pieces of bones. And what happened in this particular case is that the ivory was pulled on the day by an elephant and then dropped in the mud and then stood on by other elephants and then disappeared. And then some months later, an elephant worked away at a piece of ivory with his trunk and then extracted this whole tusk, walked around with it, and that's a really haunting and eerie moment.
It extracted the tusk from?
From the mud.
Where it had buried it?
Yeah, where it had landed, I think, accidentally. It wasn't a conscious burying of this thing, but it landed there and the mud hole dried up. But one bull eventually extracted it and then walked around with it, displayed it, and stood on it, tried to break it. We've seen this quite a lot. We've often seen elephants wander off with tusks and smash them against trees and break them against rocks and things like that.
What for?
Who knows? It's really a difficult thing to try and interpret without being too anthropomorphic, but so much of elephant behavior is focused around the mouth. So when they greet, they put a trunk into the other one's mouth, and that's the way they smell who the other one is and where they've been, what feeding's out there. And so there's so much attention paid to the mouth and the tusk area. This may be an extension of that.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Derek and Beverly Joubert, and they make films about animals in the south of Africa. They have a National Geographic special filmed in Botswana called Reflections on Elephants that will be shown February 9th on public television. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Derek and Beverly Joubert are my guest, and their National Geographic special on elephants will be shown on public television February 9th. An earlier film that you made was about lions and hyenas. It was called Eternal Enemies, and you filmed them at night. I wonder if you ever felt that you were in danger watching animals fight with each other and eat each other.
No, never, ever. We're very, very comfortable, in particular at night, because we've just spent so much time out there with lions and hyenas and elephants at night. I think that in particular when animals are busy killing each other or fighting or whatever they're doing, when they're active, they're so involved in their own lives that they totally ignore us. And the way that we've developed our relationship with them is to be totally inobtrusive. So we've really worked on trying to not influence us and try to just be invisible as much as possible.
Do you try to slowly condition the animals to your presence?
Yes, we do. When we're working with elephants, it's a slow approach that you have to do, usually from slightly behind so that they don't feel threatened. And the minute you see a reaction, then you start backing off or you head the other way or maybe just freeze. With animals at night, it's much more complex. We've worked sometimes with lions and hyenas for 6 weeks before we've been able to use our filming lights on them and film effectively.
Because they are more annoyed by the lights than by your presence?
Well, lights are a new thing to them. And so what we try to do is make sure that they thought of it as just something that was there, like another moon possibly. And the same thing with elephants. When we've got some night scenes in this new film of elephants, but they're mainly around waterholes, and the way that we did that is we would set up lights at the waterholes and just leave them there, go away for a couple of days at a time and allow the animals to approach the lighted area and go into it and feel comfortable there.
Has your reaction changed over the years to watching animals feeding on each other and attacking each other? Were you disturbed by it initially and then got used to it? Or, you know, was there any kind of emotional difference to your response?
Definitely disturbed in the beginning. I remember the first kill that I watched. It was a desperately sad one because it was so gruesome. And it was between, first of all, they tried to bring down a baby zebra, and then the lions lost it to hyenas, and this baby zebra stood up again, and it was all mauled. And then, of course, they had another fight, and the lions took it over, and that's the way it carried on. And for at least a half an hour, this baby zebra hadn't been killed yet. It was still living, but yet very badly mauled. And that was desperately disturbing. And from then on, I think all the other kills were a lot easier to watch. There are times, though, when I think the time that I really get emotionally involved is when we get to know an animal before something terrible happens to it, and that is the worst.
But you wouldn't dream of intervening?
No, we do have a policy that we're out there to document, and if man is not interfering in any way, we're not going to interfere at all. If, for example, we came across an animal that had been badly snared, we would try and intervene, but we would never intervene in nature.
You know, I think there's two instincts that that your average person would have if they saw an animal killing another animal. One is fear that when this animal's done killing the other animal, the animal's going to turn and kill you. And the other is, you know, oh, I must stop this. You know, this is something gruesome and violent and destructive that's happening. But you're able to not act on those instincts, or maybe they're not even instincts for you anymore.
No, they're not, and you have to be logical about it. And first of all, this behavior has been going on for millions, tens of millions of years. So the one little impala that you're going to save is going to make no difference at all. And it seems futile to do that. The other thing is that while you're saving that one, in the darkness, about a half a kilometer away, it's happening again. So, you know, it's just so futile and it doesn't make any sense at all. The other thing, of course, is that while on the face of things, it may look like you've been kind to save a young zebra from being eaten by a pride of lions, those lions have cubs somewhere that need to be fed as well. And so the minute you start intervening, you start unraveling this whole tapestry, and it all falls apart in your hands.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, you know, we're out there without any firearms, without any protection at all. And when hyenas or lions have already decided that they are going to try and kill whatever it is, the blood is up. For Derek and I to jump out and to try and protect whatever it is would be futile, and we would probably get a little hurt ourselves, or we could be the next prey.
Have you ever been attacked by an animal?
We have been attacked by an elephant cow. She was protecting her young. It was unknown to us that she or the little calf was even in the area. And she came out of the bushes charging and hit us. And she picked us up and she rocked the vehicle a lot. And while she was hitting us, chips of her ivory were flying into the vehicle. We eventually managed to get her to leave us. It was at night time, and Derek shone the lights in her eyes, and she eventually left us. We were unharmed, and so was she, and luckily the calf was unharmed totally as well, and the two of them went off together.
Were you afraid?
At the time, I know, I was shaking like a leaf, and obviously the adrenaline was flowing. So I guess I was definitely afraid. But we have been hit by an elephant since then. And I think living through that experience has helped me realize that if you know your subject, you definitely can get out of a situation.
Well, but how exactly did you get out of it? How did you use your knowledge to protect yourself?
Oh, well, the first thing, of course, is we knew that a strange elephant from nowhere wouldn't like to have a strong spotlight shone in her eyes. And so while she was busy bashing the side of the vehicle, instead of jumping forward and trying to hit her with something, which would have been a bit crazy anyway, because the biggest thing that we have is a big screwdriver, I managed to find the spotlight and shone that directly in her eyes. And so she turned away and covered her eyes with her ears and moved away from the vehicle. And then immediately, strangely, I felt as though I didn't want to disturb her too much. So I switched the light off, and of course she turned and ran back and bashed us around a bit more. But then when the light went on the second time, she moved off, and I kept it on for a while.
And did you try the same thing the second time you were attacked?
No, the second time around it was during the day, and so we couldn't use that weapon of light. The second time around it was an elephant that we think had been shot by a poacher, because she had a wound that we found afterwards. But she just came out of the water and gave us almost no warning at all and just ran straight for us and smashed into the front of the vehicle. There was nothing we could do then except, actually what I did do then was, as she was about to hit, I took the vehicle out of gear so that there wouldn't be a huge amount of resistance. And she hit and she pushed us down this little track that we were on for about 100 yards or so. And then I put the brakes on and then she felt the resistance and that was enough for her to feel uncomfortable and she moved off.
That's interesting.
We were feeling pretty uncomfortable too.
My guests are Derek and Beverly Joubert. Their National Geographic special on elephants airs next week on most PBS stations. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. A discussion of lifting the trade embargo against Vietnam with retired General John Vesey. He's traveled to Vietnam on behalf of President Clinton. I'll talk with Philip Knight of the Nike Shoe Company. He's donating $25,000 of his company's money to Tanya Harding's Legal Defense Fund. He says the American justice system must be allowed to work. A psychologist tells us about Sarajevo's children, 1,500 killed, 15,000 wounded. A study shows that many of the kids there are showing suicidal tendencies. And I'll talk with the actor who's supplying most of the extra voices for the new ABC television show, The Critic.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with Derek and Beverly Joubert. They live in the bush and make documentaries about African wildlife. Do you ever run into situations where there's a competing filmmaker trying to study the same herd that you are?
We have not. It has happened, and it's a very uncomfortable thing. We've kind of selected areas that are just so mean and miserable and tsetse fly-ridden that nobody else wants to work there.
Well, how do you deal with the misery of the of the area you're surrounded yourself with, like the insects, which, by the way, can cause terrible illness?
Yes, I can. Well, there's normally a precaution. I mean, for mosquitoes, there's a precaution and you can sleep on a mosquito net and, you know, that can help. When we're working at nighttime with the lights, actually, that is the worst because that attracts every single insect that is around. And they're insects that actually give out formaldehyde. They're called blister beetles. And what happens there is they put a formaldehyde onto your body and huge blisters form on your body. And then, of course, the tsetse flies are... I got a nasty burn, and luckily, because we're not in areas where we're close to villages, the tsetse flies do not carry sleeping sickness. So we're fortunate in that way that if you stay away from other communities, you normally will be safe, that you're not going to get the illness.
Boy, you know, I'm just thinking about what it's like when you have a porch light shining in the summer in the United States, and the insects from all the neighborhoods come to your porch light and just swarm around. It must be incredible in Africa when you're working at night with the lights.
It is, especially when I'm holding the lights. I mean, my whole body is just covered. It's like my body's black with insects. But I can't move because Derek is filming and we can't move the vehicle because, you know, that's almost his tripod.
So what kind of protective clothing are you wearing?
No protective clothing at all. But I'm not wriggling around or squashing them or anything like that, so normally I'm fine.
One of the problems is that even though it's nighttime out there in the insect season, it's very, very hot. And so we're using just the barest minimum of clothing, so we don't have a lot of protection from these bugs.
Now, Beverly, these films are really worth it to you to subject yourself to being covered from head to foot with insects while you film.
These films are our baby, so we'll go through everything.
Apparently you will go through everything. Do you think that you've been changed by living around animals and away from people?
I know I have. I think that every time we come into town, it takes us quite a lot of time to readjust when we go back. Find that we become much more intense. We become faster. We're not as thoughtful as we are when we're out in the bush. I think being around animals gives you a far better grasp on life and on death, and makes you a calmer, more peaceful person.
Beverly, what would you say?
I agree with all of that. There are times that when we first arrive in the cities that I'm very uncomfortable around people because obviously I'm not used to all the social activities, and there are times that I might be too abrupt because I believe that honesty is the best policy, and often you really have to be a lot more subtle. But that is what happens when you're out in the bush. You actually do feel that that it's pointless playing social games. You know, you're out there, and it's really a matter of survival often. And you respect people, I think, a lot more when you're living out in the bush.
You know, I'm thinking that what one does to protect oneself is really different, say, in the city than it is in the wild. In the wild, I imagine you try to be inobtrusive, to move very slowly, so as to not startle an animal, to be as unthreatening as possible. Whereas in the city, sometimes you really want to look threatening so that people don't bother you, you know, so that you look very kind of tough and sure of yourself. And, you know, you should have a kind of jaunty, assertive step when you walk through the street. It's in a way exactly the opposite of what you need to do in the wild.
That's right. In fact, you guys need guns here. We don't need guns at all. You're right. Walking in the bush, you need to be really quiet and walk slowly. And it's quite funny when people come out to us, we go out for a walk, and they start striding out there, really covering distance, moving fast and swinging their arms and that sort of thing. And you don't want to do that. You know, you walk very, very slowly. I find that people in New York, for instance, walk at twice the pace that I do. And you tend to melt in a little easier. For instance, if a lion charges, what you do is you don't jump up and down and assert yourself. You stand your ground and you're quiet, but confident. And if you did, and if you started running around and waving your arms, then the lion would jump on you.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you. Yeah, it was fun.
Derek and Beverly Joubert have a new documentary called Reflections on Elephants. It will air as a National Geographic special next Wednesday on many PBS stations. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services, 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After co-creating The Mary Tyler Moore Show and Rhoda, James Brooks went on to produce The Tracy Ullman Show and The Simpsons. His new movie, I'll Do Anything, co-stars Julie Kavner, who played Rhoda's sister, co-starred with Tracy Ullman, and is now the voice of Marge Simpson. We'll meet James Brooks and Julie Kavner on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.